Hello, this is Mike and Richard, and we're interviewing RDP for the FLAI Archive Committee. Hi, Arnie.
Hi, guys.
Say hi, Richard.
Hi, Arnie.
Glad you could get with us today, Arnie.
Looking forward to it.
We did send you the questions, so I think you have them. So we're going to start right away with, when and where did you sober up and get started in AA?
So I got sober April 4th of 1980 at the Pumpkin Hook Group, which was actually in Pumpkin Hook then, now the Victor Friday Night Meeting.
Nice. Who made the initial outreach to you?
Well, I didn't actually have an outreach, but it's kind of interesting because back then they would run ads in the Penny Saver, drinking problem, call this number. And not surprisingly, my wife Joy had circled that, highlighted it, and put it by our phone for a while.
So I called
Central Office. I talked with Paul P., and that was a Friday morning after a bad Thursday night, and he told me where the meeting was, and I just went to the meeting.
So you did go by yourself that first one?
Went by myself, yep.
Well, that brings us on. Do you remember your first meeting?
I do, as a matter of fact, very well. There were three other people there besides myself. One of them became my first sponsor, and the next one says, did you have a sponsor? Yes, my first sponsor, his name was Wilson, and he, at the end of that first meeting, said, I asked him, what should I do next? And he said, well, your first thing you should do is make a decision that you're going to keep away from one drink for one day. And he said, do you think you can do that? And I said, yep, I think I can do that. And he said, also, go to your next meeting. Make a plan to go to your next meeting, which was Sunday in Clifton Springs. He didn't go to a Saturday meeting. And he said, meet me at my house. I'll take you to the Sunday meeting in Clifton Springs, which I did. And the third thing he did was say you should buy a big book. I didn't have, I just kind of stood there, and he said, you don't have enough money to buy a big book, do you? And I said, no, because it didn't matter what it cost. I didn't have enough money because I didn't have a penny in my wallet. And he said, well, borrow the big book, bring it back next week. It was $4.65.
So that was the second meeting at Clifton. Who else besides your sponsor, Wilson, was prominent in your early days?
Well, I'm so lucky, blessed, however you want to say it. My second meeting, like you said, was in Clifton Springs. I looked down the row. There was a fellow named Doug H. Doug had been the best man in my wedding. I had lost track of him. He'd spent a short stint in jail for rear-ending a sheriff's car while he was drunk driving. And Doug had been sober for 3 months. So how lucky for me that one of my drinking buddies was already sober in AA. So he was instrumental. Dewey and Madeline B, Mike and Joyce D, Jim B, Ed V, bunch of us came in at about the same time and kind of helped each other along.
That's exciting to hear those names and to see that group of people that you're talking about. Now that brings up, because that's kind of into the next question, who were some of the old timers around then? What can you remember about them?
Well, a few people come to mind. Ruby, Ruby L, he was out and about. A fella named Herb K, who helped me a lot in the beginning. Big John H, and a lot of people talk about John, and I remember I knew John from the drinking days. If you were a bar drinker, you knew John. And so when I first met him, he had been sober 8 or 9 years in the program. Then he went back out for a short period of time. And he was just coming back when I was coming in. And they didn't call him Big John by accident. He weighed about 400 pounds. And I remember him putting his big hand in my face and pointing in his finger at me and saying, "Arnie, I can't tell you how to stay sober, but I can tell you how to get drunk. Stop going to meetings, you'll get drunk." Mm-hmm. and I haven't stopped going to meetings to test it yet. So
I keep hearing about the simple messages of the old timers. Pretty important.
Yep.
Who's the oldest living AA member you know?
I would say John G. He got sober in 1957. So he's either 64 or 65 years sober. I don't know his exact anniversary date. But he got sober when he was 21, which was pretty amazing back in those days. And I could relate. You know, I was 24 when I got sober. So
64 years, that's brilliant.
Yeah, it's amazing.
How many groups or meetings were around when you got started?
I would say probably about half of the number there is now. But the majority of the meetings were pretty well attended. I mean, the attendance tends to go up and down. But like I said, the first Victor meeting I went to, or Pumpkin Hook meeting, was only 4 people. But in a short period of time, that was up to 15 or 20. You could go to a meeting every night within a 20-mile drive of where I lived in Farmington.
Did you have a home group back then?
I did. The Pumpkin Hook group was my home group. My first meeting became my home group.
That's kind of easier to do when you first come in. That's what I did.
Yep.
What were the meetings like?
Most of them were lead meetings. You know, someone would share for 10 or 15 minutes and open it up for a topic. Of course, still some speaker meetings, like Clifton was always the speaker meeting. But pretty much lead meetings and speaker meetings.
Mm-hmm. Were they held? Was the meetings held differently back then?
You know, I don't think a lot differently. There was almost always the chairperson called on somebody to speak, and it seems like the chairperson steered the meeting a little bit more than they do now, maybe. They kind of knew who to call on if the meeting started to get a little bit out of control, and they were a little more likely to say, you know, to cut you off in a nice way if you started to go off track, or even to say, "Hey, you're getting a little off track," or "That would be better shared after the meeting," or "That would be better shared with your sponsor." So it seems like the chairperson had a little more control maybe than they do now.
I definitely hear and see that in meetings.
Yep.
Okay, in the early days, how did AA treat newcomers, consistent slippers, or 13 steppers?
So I was thinking with newcomers, probably they were involved a little bit more on a personal basis. People were more likely to take somebody into their home, or I don't mean overnight, but just to say, "Hey, why don't you meet me at my house before the meeting?" Or "Come and do something with my family." It seemed like there was more involvement on a personal basis than there is now. And I think probably a little bit more involvement with the family. I think about in the book, The Family Afterward chapter, and a little bit more of an effort to, if there was a spouse or kids, to, you know, like I said, to get involved and not just say, "Hey, see you at the meeting," or whatever the case may be, a little bit more one-on-one personal involvement. And when it comes to constant slippers, I don't know that there were many. It doesn't seem to me there were many. I'm not sure why, but it doesn't seem like there were quite as many people. I'm not saying there weren't slips, but there was more. Somebody would have 6 months maybe and go back out. I only remember one particular fella, and he shared with me when I was about 2 years sober. He said, "Arnie, AA has worked for me." He said, "I've been in Alcoholics Anonymous for probably 22 or 23 years. I probably have spent 90 to 95% of that time sober. The most I've ever had is a couple years, but AA still worked for me." And it kind of bothered me a little bit, because I thought, I didn't want to be that. I didn't want to say, well, I'll just kind of use it as a maintenance program. But other than that, I can't really. It was more of a surprise if somebody slipped, I think. And let's see, 13 steppers. A few things were different then than now. If there was, and it was probably more men picking on women than the other way around. Although I do remember one situation that was the other way around. But if somebody made a pattern of it, then people within the group would talk with what I'm going to call the offender and basically chastise them and say, this isn't a dating service. This isn't what you're here for. You're spoiling somebody's opportunity to get sober. So there was a little bit more policing, I think, within the ranks. So I think that was. And the other thing that happened is if that didn't work, then there was a tendency to warn the newcomer. An older or more established female in the group would say to the female newcomer, "You want to be very careful about Joe," because he's got a reputation of being a little inappropriate with the ladies. So, it would hit a little more head-on probably than it is now.
And I think that goes right along to how they treat the newcomers. That personal touch goes through all three of those categories.
Yep.
Yes, okay. How were people wishing to talk about multiple, or I'm sorry, how were people wishing to talk about multiple addictions addressed? How about non-alcoholic drug addicts walking in off the street to their first meeting?
I don't think people were as harsh as some would say, at least not in our area. I think it was certainly addressed that here's our primary purpose, and we have to stick with our primary purpose, and you have to have a desire to stop drinking. And if you're a drug addict who has a desire to stop drinking, you're welcome. Limit your sharing to as much extent as possible to how alcohol affects your life. But I don't remember real militants. I don't remember anybody saying, "Hey, you're a drug addict, you're not welcome at our meeting." I don't remember any of that.
And that again goes to that personal way we treat the newcomer. Did your group hold a group conscience?
Yes. Yeah. Pretty much monthly.
And it's today's group conscience is a lot to do with finances and maybe some determination of what the group wants to do in their format. Is that kind of what the group conscience were back then too?
Or if there were particular issues. And you mentioned 13th stepping or if there was inappropriate behavior that was addressed at the group conscience. A lot of discussion around our common welfare should come first. In other words, saying we have to subvert the individual's desire or the individual's expression a little bit more probably than what it is today. Is that, look, it doesn't say your welfare should come first. It says our common welfare should come first. So.
Now, I want, it just sparked, today we open our group conscience to everybody who wants the best interest of the group. Is that, were they open group conscience back then also?
No, home group only.
Okay. What controversies over issue addressed in the traditions can you remember people wrestling with?
Mostly principles before personality.
Just trying to remember. Okay, were there different differences that led to formation of new groups?
Yes. Sometimes strong individual personalities, but I think more often than not, a separation like during group conscience. A big deal was smoking, non-smoking, when smoking was still allowed, even in the church basements and so forth. But smoking became not as acceptable social behavior. A lot of groups split into a smoking and non-smoking. And then I think the other was special interest. Any number of special interest groups that said, okay, you know, we're going to be a gay meeting, or we're going to be a women's meeting, or whatever the case may be, men's meeting, whatever the case may be. That, I think, were the situations where differences formed a group.
Okay. I like that. When I first came in, I heard a lot of a resentment at coffee pot is all I need.
Yeah. and a certain amount of ego, too, I think, Mike. I think there would be a certain amount of ego if somebody said, oh, that's Arnie's meeting, and we don't like the way Arnie runs the meeting, or whatever the case may be, then they would splinter off.
Mm-hmm. Was there a central office when you came in, and what was it like?
Yep. It was Rochester. You could have, and there was a full-time, Paul P. was a full-time, I don't remember what his, you know, title was, per se, but he was the paid, full-time person who ran the central office. So Paul was there, and almost always there were other people around answering the phones or just coming to hang out, because there would be, in between meetings and so forth, people would go and hang out at the central office. And then in Finger Lakes, Prudy, of course, and even though it was in her house, I'd say a lot the same way. She was very welcoming, and people would not just go to do business per se. They would go and hang out.
Now, this next one, I've been in the Finger Lakes and AA a little bit. I know how special they are to me. But what special occasions do you remember? Assemblies, conventions, conferences, picnics, group activities, etc.?
Lots and lots of them. I mean, especially in the early days, the picnics were super important to Joy and I. And I can remember one time going to the Rochester picnic up by the zoo, and they had extra hot dogs. And as silly as this sounds, they were selling the hot dogs for like $1 a packet, and we bought 4 or 5 packets of hot dogs, and we had a good time. And, you know, we didn't have any money to speak of, and just the fellowship, going and having fun, that was certainly the picnics, the dances, and people would have different, we had Halloween parties a couple years, and out at my Oaks Ski Lodge, probably the bigger conferences. I mean, when 1985, Joy and I went to Montreal for the International Conference, and we got to meet Lois Wilson, so that was pretty cool. And, like the Toronto conferences, but both the big things and the little things. I remember Father Martin coming to talk a couple times in Geneva. That was a big deal. So lots of cool stuff. The fellowship. I was saying today at a meeting, the saying, a fellowship will grow up around you. I didn't even know what that meant. I mean, Why would I want to publish if I grow up around them and what it means? But those things are what helped the fellowship to grow up around me.
Yeah, I think that's the, with the next question, how it wraps around that, what kind of 12-step work was going on?
A lot more, I think, direct. Like I said, people taking, there was a lot more places to take a wet drunk to, you know, rehab centers, VA, entry to care up in Rochester, Salvation Army, different things. And there probably wasn't as many options. So you, it seemed like you did a lot more 12-step work, direct 12-step work. And it said one of 12-step stories that you'd like to share. Funny one, and this will relate to this, because he'll remember it. There used to be a bar in between Victor and East View Mall called Cato's Triangle. And it was a pretty divey, rough place. And I got a call one night from the bartender saying, there's a guy here who's being a real idiot, and he says that he wants to get sober, and he gave me your phone number. Will you come and get him out of here? So I called another fellow, and it was about 1 o'clock in the morning, maybe, and we went and picked him up. And the funny thing was, the bartender, we get there, and he says, I'm not going unless I have another beer. And it was, by then, it was after the last call. And the bartender said, will you promise me I take him out of, you'll take him out of here if I give him another beer? I said, I'll do the best I can. He said, then here you go, buddy. And gave him a bottle and took him to the VA. And that fella's sober today. And Casos has probably been torn down, 25 years ago, maybe. I don't know. Long time ago.
That's a beautiful story of the 12-step. Now, I did want to go back one question because I forgot the Finger Lakes Convention. Were you around when it started? How much did the impact?
I was around when it started. Dave Kay and I, along with Cheryl and a couple, Bill R., and a couple other people, decided we wanted to have a convention. Probably more Dave Kay than anyone else because he was involved with the Rochester Conference. So he and I got together enough money each so that we could go and reserve the inn on the lake. And we definitely took a risk. And we went out and said, okay, we've made the deposit, and now we have to get enough people to show up. And a few things that were really cool that we did back then, I think one of the best things was alternating the sex of the chairperson, or gender, I guess is probably a more appropriate word, but alternating the gender of the chairperson. And the other thing that we did that was really smart, and Joy was the first Al-Anon chairperson, Dave was the first AA chairperson, is we involved Al-Anon right from the beginning. And that helped the fellowship to grow up around us because, you know, we got to know each other. We got to work together and we got to know each other. And it was truly amazing. In the first conference, Dave and I were, you know, counting our coins all the time to say, gee, are we going to be able to pay for all the coffee? And gee, how much are we going to owe when this is all said and done? Because neither one of us were wealthy. We both had enough money to come up with a down payment, but we were pretty nervous about how much coffee we were going to drink and all those other things. So,
well, that's exciting, and I hope it gets back to normal here
next
year. I really miss them. They mean a ton, and I know Jim and other people we've talked to about the special beginning of the convention here. So thank you for that.
Yep.
Okay, what kind of contributions did you make to the growth of the fellowship? This is no time for false modesty.
Well, we already talked about Conference of the Lakes. The other thing we did is started a clubhouse, which failed. It was the old range right on Route 31 near Lollipop Farm. We, Dave and I, again, you know, went out on a limb and we rented the place and tried to have meetings there. And it just never took off. I think it was too far. You know, it was just between. It wasn't convenient or any place. And the group just wasn't ready. The area just wasn't ready for a clubhouse. And it still kind of interests me because now that I'm here in South Carolina, there's a lot of clubhouses. But upstate New York, for whatever reason, clubhouses just never have taken off that much, you know. So I think that was a big deal. I think the other thing, and this is a little bit odd maybe, but several people in AA got involved with Super Bowl Party for the Homeless. Obviously, it wasn't anything to do directly with AA, but lots of AA members, not exclusively, but lots of AA members got involved with Super Bowl Party for the Homeless. And that just made a huge impact on us and I think lots of others as well. So
that's a nice story. I've never heard that. That's cool. 21, what kind of relationships did AA have with local authorities, judge courts, and how has that changed?
I think many more than now. And how it changed, and it's probably an outside issue, but I think we're so much more a litigious society. People are so much more likely to sue each other, and you know, you can't tell me what to do, and you can't recommend a spiritual solution. So there was a lot more direct involvement with judges, with police officers, than there is now. Yep.
When you first got sober, did AA interact with the media, and has that changed?
You know, I don't know. That's one of the questions I put. I'm not sure because I really don't have any perspective, Mike. I don't know.
Mm-hmm. I think the newspaper was pretty much where I saw AA anything back anytime. But okay, when you first got sober, how did AA act with? Oh, I just asked that one. Sorry. In early years of your recovery, how did the community receive AA?
I would say quite receptive, you know, generally receptive. I think that most people understood they knew somebody in the community that was involved with AA. They had a sense that it was making a difference. So I think it had a good reputation.
And I guess that's the next one. Is it any different than you encountered through, is AA's repetition any different than you encountered through your first introduction?
Yes. I think the big difference is AA now is more perceived as a self-help program than it is a spiritual program. By the general community, I think if you would say, what is AA? They would say it's the self-help program. Yeah. And that's something that I'm not particularly happy about. I think also, and not that it's bad, that there's a lot of other 12-step programs, but sometimes it can almost be a joke. You know, I can't think of a habit, but any habit anonymous. You know, Cookie Eaters Anonymous or, you know, it just seems like in some regards, that's the big difference I see. It self-help versus the spiritual program.
What special memories do you remember during your time of service?
Many. The first one that came to mind was we ended up taking in a foster child for a year and a half through an organization called Homes and Service Ministry. And the focus of that was mothers who were alcoholic and or drug addict who were having the baby and wanted to keep it. So the goal was to bring them into a family, give them a healthy environment where they could have their child and help them through the time that they were carrying the child and the first year afterwards. And we ended up working with a young woman, and it just opened our eyes so tremendously. Later on, and, you know, so many times, and that's probably one of the wonderful things about AA, it isn't always a happy ending and a success story. It just isn't. I mean, she came with us. She didn't have her baby. She stayed sober for a while, after, you know, during and for a while afterwards. Many years later, she called Joy, and by then she was up to four children, the oldest being 8 or 9, and the children were being taken away from them. And we ended up taking them in, and Ron and Bonnie P. took the baby in and kept them with us. You know, they kept Samantha, well, I shouldn't say that. They kept the baby, we kept the other three boys. And, you know, meetings and all of that. But it was just a way to, so a way to get out of self. But I mean, I could list numerous ways. But that one comes to mind, especially the day that we came to stay with us. She had had 2 or 3 home visits. And the day that she came to stay with us, we pulled into our driveway, and she said to me, "I never thought I'd live with rich people." And I said, "Well, Kathy, we're not rich. And, you know, we're doing okay and everything, but we're not rich." And she said, "Yes, you are. You have your own car, and it runs. And it, you know, it can go from Rochester to Farmington." She said, "You own your own house. There's food in your refrigerator, because I looked the last couple of times I was here."
That's beautiful.
She said, "You have furniture in your rooms." She said, "You're rich." And I said, "You know what, Kathy? You're right." So many times, by providing service, it brings us out of self and also helps us to be grateful. And, you know, and to remember, but for the grace of God, there's a life, you know. So that's probably, I could talk and talk about that, but that's the answer to that question.
Beautiful, Arnie. Oh, it's hard to go on after that, but since the COVID pandemic began, how have you managed to stay connected and a part of the fellowship?
A few things. Lots of phone calls. I reach out a lot. And down here in the South, they are not as in-person meetings never went completely out down here, especially in the clubhouses. There's a clubhouse either side of me, about 20 miles either side of me. And those clubhouses, because they were, you know, run by the club, they never shut down their meetings. So it's been a little easier for me than some people. I have done Zoom some, although I find it, I have to do a lot of Zoom through my work. So a Zoom AA meeting kind of feels like work to me. So I don't do that as much. But a lot of reading. I mean, I'm a big believer. Most every night before I go to sleep, I read the 12 and 12, the big book, Bible, Emmett Fox, something. So probably a little bit more reading, but still reaching out, you know, staying connected. Yeah.
And thank goodness for today's technology that makes that easier.
Yeah.
Okay. How would you sum up your journey, your AA journey, in a few words or sentences?
In a few words, I have been given a personal relationship with a God that I know and love, and I know that he loves and knows me. So that, I mean, I don't have any illusions of grandeur. You know, in the book it says, he's the father, we're his children, he's the employer, we're the employee. I understand what the relationship is, but it is an active relationship. That's huge. The other thing that we talked a little bit about, a fellowship to grow up around you, real friendship with people, some of whom I don't even know their last name. And you know, that's the funny part. You know, I don't even know their last name. To a great extent, the ability to be genuine, not completely, but to be genuine. The other thing is to strive for some sort of balance, especially in my household where it's more difficult. I'm a little better at not being quite as sensitive. You know, John the Indian used to say he got hurt easily and didn't suffer well. I try not to get hurt as easily, and I try to suffer a little better. I try not to be quite as reactive and immature. You know, that's one thing that us alcoholics don't like, but most all of the extensive studies on alcoholics say that we are much more emotionally immature than the average. I wish that wasn't the case, and I can say that it's better. It's not perfect, but and if I didn't say it already, the ability to receive love, the ability to show up for the people that I care about, and occasionally hurt them accidentally, but not to hurt them on purpose, not just to go out and say, boy, I'm going to make your life miserable. So that's not a few words, that's a lot of words, but
they all needed to be said, so thank you. Now, what would you, this is, I really like this question because it really means a lot to why we're doing this. What would you have to say to the new person that may be listening to this recording sometime in the future?
Well, I tell them to look at page 164 in the big book. And I don't have it in front of me and I don't have it memorized. But I would tell them, first of all, people will say, give AA. AA doesn't need a chance. AA is doing fine. Give yourself a chance. And what I mean by that is keep away from one drink for one day. Go to meetings on a regular basis. Open yourself up to share with other people. Be at least willing to consider a higher power. You know, our book says God does not make too hard terms for those who earnestly seek him. So be willing to open yourself up to seek God of your understanding, because that changes. My understanding of God has changed. God hasn't changed. My understanding of God has changed over these many years. And you know, the cliche, life beyond your wildest dreams, doesn't mean much. You know, it really doesn't mean much, because if it's beyond my dreams, I can't imagine. But truly, the thing, you know, the ability to give them the love, to be genuine about who I am, what I am, and to know that with God, I'm actually enough. And so I don't know, for the newcomer, give yourself a chance. And, you know, they say, we'll love you till you learn to love yourself. And there are, you know, a lot of cliches, but cliches are cliches for a reason. So join us, because I need you. That's the other thing that I need to tell you, is that I need you. The lifeblood of Alcoholics Anonymous is the new person coming in the door. And so that's not very eloquent, but that's the way I would do it is give yourself a chance and enjoy the journey. You know, it's a journey. Enjoy the journey.
Beautiful. I have one more question because I know Yarny, and I'd like you to tell me what you tell people at the end of your story, the three things.
Oh, the three things. The three things are life is worth living. And what I mean by that is a lot of times people in Alcoholics Anonymous, the emotional pain is so great. I mean, let's face it, we used alcohol for a reason. We used it for a reason, and then it turned on us. So the reason is because we have perhaps the emotional or mental disorders. So we remove the alcohol, and sometimes people think, what's the use? Life isn't worth living. So number one, life is worth living. And if you don't feel that way, get some help. You know, just get some help, professional help, because life is worth living. People are worth loving. If you love somebody, tell them now. Don't wait. And, you know, don't be too proud to say, I love you. I mean, I have many, many times, even in this last 2 weeks, told another man that I love him. But I've also told my wife, my granddaughter, my great-grandson, if you love somebody, tell them now. The people are worth loving. And God is worth trusting. And I often say, I didn't say people are worth trusting, because we're human, we're fallible, we'll let each other down. You know, it doesn't a week go by that I don't let somebody down. Maybe myself, maybe somebody else. I was going to say, doesn't a day go by, but I can say now there are days that go by where I don't let anybody down. At least to my knowledge. But so God is worth trusting. Yeah. And, you know, in our water stuff, it says there's one who has all power. That one is God. May you find him now. So now means in the present moment. It doesn't mean at that point in the book. It means at this present moment, find God. And if I can just draw near to God, my instinct is, when I'm off the beam, is to hide from God, to pull away from him. And it's just so important that I draw closer to him. And so those are the three. Life is worth living, people are worth loving, and God is worth trusting. So that's it.
Awesome, Arnie. I really appreciate it, and I'm happy we got to do this. I'm going to shut the recorder off. So thank you, Richard, for being here, and thank you so much, Arnie.
Yeah, and thank you guys for doing this. It's a lot of work, and thank you guys for doing it.